yesterday, I want to thank Dr. Weil for organizing this session, and great PHA for putting this on the agenda. It's an important topic. And so I'm going to talk about, is there a clicker? Do we have a clicker? Or, you know, I actually have one if we don't.
This one?
Oh, there we go. Okay, good. My apologies for getting here late. I didn't realize the bus was going to be 45 minutes later. I assumed it was going to be a really quick bus ride. But anyway, I think I have to give this non-disclosure. Is that right? I have to say this. I have no relationships to disclose. Before I start talking about our safety cultures and the changes that we have made at UCLA, and I'm pleased to see that we have actually made some changes. I want to give you a little bit of heads up on the research that's being done at UCLA. We're a pretty large institution. We have over $1 billion in research. We have 713 PIs, and we're pretty confident that's an accurate number. When we started looking at this, we really didn't have a good idea. Our first estimate on laboratory rooms was about 2,500. And as we started covering more, we realized that we have over 3,700 now. We have approximately 16,000 researchers. That number is sort of soft. We're still not 100% sure about that, which is, I don't know, Pete, you have this issue, but I know a lot of large academic institutions, particularly public institutions that are very decentralized, have problems nailing down these figures. A lot of companies would be aghast at knowing this, but academic institutions have a hard time tracking this for some reason. And there are about 7,000 faculty and academic staff. So, much of this discussion that we're all talking about today and safety culture and academic institutions really resulted from a tragic accident that occurred at UCLA in 2008, December 2008. Sherry Sanji was working with a prior four chemical and somehow it splashed on her, and she wasn't wearing appropriate PPE, and there were a number of things associated with that. And unfortunately, she subsequently died as a result of her serious burns. There have been a number of other accidents since that incident. There was one at Purdue. There was a big one at Texas Tech. I think that was kind of instrumental in getting the Chemical Safety Board involved in these investigations. That was the first time they looked at investigating an academic laboratory. Typically, they had looked at large-scale industrial accidents. This accident was one that I'd like to show. There weren't many injuries. It was at the University of Missouri, but it was in a biochemistry lab. And you know, when I've been talking at UCLA about the need for making improvements and the need for changing the way we operate and the need for PPE, you know, there are a lot of sort of disciplines that basically don't agree that all of these things are necessary because they work with safe things. You know, biochemists are notorious for this. They say, well, we're not like the organic chemists. You know, they're the ones that work with all these pyrophores and explosives and, you know, high energy substances. We work with aqueous-based solutions, and we don't have these risks. Well, this is a biochemistry lab in the University of Missouri that had a huge explosion. They were very fortunate not to have any deaths, because it could have easily resulted in fatalities. And obviously, the accident at Yale, where there was someone working in a shop associated with a laboratory who died. She was working alone, apparently, and that's another tragic accident. More recently, there was an accident in San Francisco on the biosafety side, where there was 2001, he died of bacterial meningitis, and it was confirmed that this was a result of the work that he was doing in the laboratory. Another one at Colorado State, and most recently there was an accident here, and probably most of you are aware of this accident. This was an accident at Dow Chemical. Again, apparently this individual was working alone. I still haven't heard all the details about what happened in this, with this accident, but he was working with a pyrophoric, a different type of pyrophoric, and he suffered some burns and died as a result of his injuries. So, the accident at UCLA had a profound impact on us, my office, and the entire campus, and it prompted a campus-wide review of our procedures and processes. And the chancellor wanted a report prepared, and so this report was prepared July 2009, so about 6 months after the accident, where there were a number of things that were identified as being problems. One was there was a lack of accountability and oversight. There needed to be better outreach and training. Laboratory design often needed a lot of improvement and still does. Unfortunately, laboratory design is one of those things where infrastructure, once it's set, it's very expensive to make improvements. We're doing that slowly. They identified a need for much more robust inventory record keeping. And finally, and this is kind of the piece all together, they recognized the need for developing a stronger safety culture. So, safety culture is one of these amorphous things that people don't really quite know what it is. This is the definition from Wikipedia, and it just says the way safety is managed in the workplace, it reflects attitudes, beliefs, perceptions, and values. And this is as good as any. One of the things that we recognize that was really important at UCLA that we do to sort of get on that road towards improving our safety culture was making sure people knew what was expected of them. What are the expectations of the researchers? So we put together this pretty long sense of list, and I've seen folks cut this down and make it a lot shorter. I'm working with a group with the Department of Energy, and they've actually cut this down to like 4 bullet points. So this is, you know, roughly together it's 28 bullet points, and they cut it down to 3. But what we did was we developed this just to let people know, and it's divided between PIs and laboratory researchers, and it tells them exactly what it is that they're expected to do. What are the expectations and the roles of them? So that was really important to make sure we set the stage and let everyone know what the expectations were. So, as part of this, we wanted to make sure that our laboratory supervisors and PIs were trained. Now, this was kind of a heresy because, of course, they know everything already. These are people that have been working, as Pete said, in some cases 40 years, and have doing things without any kind of incidents in the laboratory. So certainly they know what they're doing, and they don't need us to tell them, how to be safe in the laboratory. Well, there was a recognition, and part of this was driven by Cal OSHA. Cal OSHA, rightly so, said, well, how can you expect your supervisors and PIs to train their staff when they don't know what they need to train them on, and they don't know all the basic functions of, So we embarked on this, and we very carefully embarked on this, because getting those of you in academic institutions know that getting PIs to do certain things is very difficult sometimes. So we started this process, and we actually indicated that it's required that all PIs and lab supervisors undergo lab safety training. And in 2010, we launched this, and we had a pretty good response. It was actually surprising to me that we had almost 50% of the folks that did this training without a whole lot of effort on our part. We basically let them know that it was available and it was required, and that they showed up. Well, 2011 was a little bit more arm twisting. busy to do this. One of the ways we were able to do this was we actually had our chancellor, who's been very engaged in this process, attend the very first training. And now our vice chancellor for research and all the senior administrators who had faculty appointments and did research also were there. So it was really hard for other PIs to say, I don't have time, when these folks in fact did have time. And finally, last year, this year, we were able to maintain 100% of every PI on campus at UCLA has gone through PI training for about the first 8 months, which is, you know, for me, this is probably one of the biggest accomplishments that my office has made, because it's such a big deal. And so we're hoping to maintain that. We're being very vigilant whenever there's a new PI coming on board to make sure they undergo this so we can keep it at 100%. So, and this is just part of our overall lab safety training that we've done since 2007. That's when I joined UCLA, and there's been an exponential increase in training ever since then, and we've had a 640% increase in both classroom and online training. And there are ways in which we did this, and if you're interested, I can get into that later. I'm not going to talk about it now, since it's given a little bit of time. But in laboratory safety, we've had, and that was all safety training, laboratory safety, we've had a similar increase, 555% increase overall. And in 2013, we're on target to even be over in 2012. So, one of the other things that we did, in light of making sure people are aware of what it is expected, we actually put together formal policies on PPE. And this was not an easy thing either, but we got this in place, and there were some minimum requirements. The minimum requirements are that you must wear full-length pants and closed-toed shoes whenever you enter a lab. And then, from then on, depending on what the hazards are in your laboratory, you may need gloves, you may need lab coats, you may need eye protection, flame-resistant lab coats if you're working with pyrophoric flammables. So it escalates up depending on what the hazards are that you're working with, all right? But at a minimum, you need closed-toed shoes and full-length pants in when you're working in the laboratory, right? And there's some other details about cotton undergarments and that kind of stuff, but essentially this is the bottom line. And we let people know, this is what the expectations are, this is what you have to do when you go into a laboratory. To make sure that people were complying with that, we actually put together a PPE compliance program where we did unannounced PPE compliance inspections in laboratories. And it's very short, this is just a one-page checklist on are you wearing your closed-toed shoes, are you wearing long pants, are you wearing eye protection gloves, depending on what the hazards are that you're working with. All of that, it's a checklist. Literally, this takes 10 minutes. We have our inspectors go in to buildings, and they do the inspections, and they're in and out really quickly. Now, they do identify the problem. If they see something egregious going on, they'll make sure that gets corrected right then and there. And if it's something that needs to be referred to a fire safety specialist or a radiation safety specialist or the fire marshal, they'll make note of that as well and report. This is primarily for personal protective equipment, make sure we're in compliance. So, we started this in 2010, and we found that 71% of the labs that we went to were actually compliant with the policy, which we were very happy about. There were 29% that were non-compliant. And the reasons for the non-compliance were varied, but primarily they were because of food and drink. That was the big one. We looked at food and drink in the laboratory. As far as PPE is concerned, most of them were not compliant in the lab coats. They weren't wearing lab coats when they should have. They didn't have proper eye protection. They weren't wearing proper gloves. And probably the biggest one, the one that's the hardest right now, is open-toed shoes. A lot of people are wearing open-toed shoes. And I think a lot of people don't quite understand what that is and what that means. A lot of people are wearing ballet slippers and think, oh, well, the toes are covered, but the whole foot is not, you know. So we're going to go through some educational efforts to make sure that people quite understand what it is, what a closed-toed shoe really means. And we're going to develop a video, hopefully out this later this year, on that. And so in 2011, we got a little bit better with regard to compliance. It was 76% versus 24% for non-compliance. But what was interesting about this is that the reasons why they were non-compliant were very different than they were the previous year. The reason why they weren't compliant were primarily because of food and drink and non-PPE related things. So you've got a relatively small percentage of violations, if you will, because of actual PPE. So, you know, this is indicating that people are changing maybe their behaviors. And I can certainly speak to that just by going walking through the hallways of these laboratories. I can see people, it's night and day what people are wearing. I mean, they're wearing lab coats, they're wearing long pants, they're wearing closed toed shoes. I mean, it's just anecdotal, but this gives you some actual data to support that. And in 2012, it continues to get better. We were at 94% compliance. And the reasons for the non-compliances are, again, primarily non-PPE related. Food and drink, non-PPE. And again, the open-toed shoes, which is the purple, that's the biggest single factor in why people are non-compliant. So this is all very encouraging news. And I think I have one more for 2013 so far. And it's gone down even further. We're now at 4% non-compliance. And again, you know, similar reasons. Open-toed shoes seems to be, again, the biggest problem there. So that's one of the things that we're going to target. But overall, this is really an incredible improvement. And to date, probably the most quantitative information that we have on there has been a tangible change in safety culture. Now, anecdotally, again, I can see it walking through hallways, and I can see people worrying all the PPE that they should. But this actually put some data on this. And this shows that it's been pretty dramatic. In 3 years, you know, we've gone from, significant level of non-compliance to very insignificant level of non-compliance. And so I think, this is really important. We're hoping to get more of this information and tailor it down and actually publish this, because we think this is really an important, and some of the steps that we took to get this actually, I think we've been very successful, and I think it's very transferable to other institutions. So it's something that we want to get the word out. And so this just gives you a little overall view from 2010 to 2013 on the changes. And again, this is all part of our overall research safety inspections. Again, you can see a huge increase in the number of inspections that we've done, you can see them delineated between lab, radiation safety, biosafety, and PPE. Our PPE compliance inspections have increased significantly. We were on target to do over 1,000 unannounced PPE compliance inspections this year. And it's going to exceed what we did in 2012. But overall, our inspection numbers have continued to increase. Now, we do expect a decrease in 2013, and the reason for that, and actually it's a good thing, is we go back and do re-inspections until those items are closed out. And what we're finding now is that it's taking less time to close out the findings, and so we don't have to re-inspect as frequently as we were in the past. And so again, that's something that I'm very encouraged by. Part of it's infrastructure, so once you fix a broken fume hood, typically it's going to stay unbroken for a while. Or if you install a safety shower where it needs to be installed, it's in there, so you don't have to go back and do that inspection. But these are also operational things too, and that's one thing that we're going to be looking at closely at the data, and hopefully get that published as well. And you can just see the increase in the inspections; it's been pretty significant. And in lab safety inspections, again. It's even more. Some of the other things that we're doing to try to improve laboratory safety is, as Miriam indicated, we started a center for laboratory safety, and that center is really focused on three things. The mission is really to focus on research. We want to do research into laboratory safety, and we want to actually take that research and transfer it into actual implementation. It's things that we can implement across the board. So we want to publish information, get it out there, let people know what it is, and what we want to do with the compliance inspections, and actually encourage people to actually implement some of these things in their own programs. There was a lot of interest in the center, and there were a number of articles that came out on that. One thing that we did, and Pete mentioned this in his talk, was that we did a laboratory safety survey in conjunction with a couple of partners. We had 30,000 invitations. We've measured safety on a global scale. There were 2,300 respondents. Most of them were from academia. Most of those were from chemistry, biochemistry, or biology, and most of them from the United States. And we're actually, we are in the process of culling through this data. There have been some publications on this information, but we're looking at in a lot more detail. I didn't really put it on the screen in the short amount of time that I have, but it is something that we're looking at. We're actually in the process of writing a paper on this as well, and I think there's going to be some really interesting findings on that. But overall, I think there's some really encouraging things that are happening with regard to safety culture. It's one of those hard things to really nail down what it is and what's going to really make improvements. But I think some of the things that we've done at UCLA are transferable to other institutions, and I think they really have made a really positive impact on